Well, yesterday afternoon we were at home, and the grandchildren were gone for a while, and we turned on the TV, and somebody had left it on PBS the previous day, and immediately the first thing we saw was some 60s rock stars, black and white. It was a fundraising show that they had on, and excerpts from the Ed Sullivan Show. Now, I didn't live in the United States back then, so this was all new to me. But I did recognize some of those groups. And I'm sure Mike and Bob would have done too, because, you know, Mike was at the premiere of It's a Wonderful Life. You heard him say that. So, you know, he'd remember as well these artists from the 60s. And it was all black and white. You had Mick Jagger, you know, jumping around. Of course, he still is 40 years later, but it must be quite painful now. And, you know, when Jerry and the Pacemakers came on, somebody made the comment that they probably all got their very own pacemakers now. But it was really amusing. And some of the groups we'd forgotten all about, like the Animals, who looked really tame in the 1960s on the Ed Sullivan Show. But at the time, I'm sure a lot of parents were, you know, tearing their hair out, thinking that their kids were watching these people. But it's all rather tame now. But, you know, the 60s music, revival, whatever you want to call it, was a major social phenomenon, along with other changes at the same time. In between some of these excerpts from the Ed Sullivan Show, they mentioned that the favorite TV show in the year that the Beatles arrived here, which was 1964, was Father Knows Best. And a lot of people claim that the arrival of the Beatles is what changed America more than anything. I mean, there is this sense that everything changed in the 1960s, and that's true. Because all you've got to do, really, is look back, read anything from the 50s, the 40s, 30s, you know, look at any TV shows, any movies, you see just how much things have changed. And it all really came with the 1960s. And the Beatles have often been blamed for that. But in actual fact, it goes back a bit earlier than that. A friend of mine sent me a book a while ago by a man called Fred Kaplan. I haven't read the book yet. I've skimmed it, and I did look at it briefly for the purposes of giving this particular sermon. But the book was titled 1959. And, of course, 2 days ago, it was actually 2009. Now it's not. But it's 50 years since 1959. And the book shows just the changes that came in the last year of the 1950s. And they devote one chapter to a fundamental change, a major change that took place in December of 1959. So exactly 50 years and a couple of days ago, December 1959, and that was the invention of the birth control pill. This was to have broad social implications. Earlier in the year, the obscenity laws had been changed. I still remember this. I was at school in England at the time, and it was very much talked about that a case had been brought by the British courts and also over here in the United States, according to this book, against the publishers of D.H. Lawrence's Lady Chatterley's Lover. And D.H. Lawrence actually lived in my hometown area, just the next town, like 5 miles away, that's all. And he lived there during World War I. And so it was kind of a local sensation. And the book he had written was banned for decades. And then the publishers published it without permission in 1959. And they were taken to court for this because the book contained words and other things which were considered highly inappropriate. And they lost their case, as a result of which the obscenity laws were being ignored when it came to prose, not when it came to pictures, but when it came to the written word, the law was obviously being flouted from that particular time. Anyway, at the end of that year, the pill was approved by the federal government for use by the public, but it was promoted as a pill for menstrual disorders. The people who manufactured it, I've forgotten the name of the company, but the manufacturers knew that it would never be approved as a birth control pill. So they applied for it to be approved for women with menstrual disorders. It's interesting to read the background. I just read the one chapter 24 of this book. But Margaret Sanger, you know, who's now a hero of the feminist movement, Margaret Sanger had been a big influence all through the first decades of the 20th century. She was actually the publisher and editor of Socialist News. She was a socialist. She was very supportive of the communist revolution in Russia, the Bolshevik Revolution. And she basically hated men because, you know, her own mother had died very young, and her own mother had had many children. And the account in the book is that when her mother died, at the funeral, she turned to her father and said, "You are responsible for this. It's your fault that mama's died so young," because, you know, she had had so many children. So she blamed it all on her father. And it became then a lifetime's goal to, you know, change the rules, basically, and to change the way that things were done. And she didn't hate men so much that she didn't marry one that was very wealthy. She married a guy who was very wealthy. There's always exceptions, you know. She married a guy who was very wealthy, and he actually gave her $50,000 to do whatever she wanted with it to achieve her political goals. And so what she did is she put it into research to find a pill that would stop women from having children, because she knew that nothing else would work. So this is what she did. And she talked to one of the leading researchers, medical researchers, who did the research. It took years, but finally they did come up with this pill. And when it came out, it was approved for menstrual disorders, but the inventor secretly let out in medical journals that it would also stop women from getting pregnant. Suddenly, hundreds of thousands of women claimed to have menstrual disorders and were prescribed the pill. The birth rate dropped so dramatically that by 1965, Congress decided to change the immigration laws to let in people from third world countries, including vast numbers of people from the Middle East, from Africa, and so on. And, of course, that has led to the problems that we've got now, you know, with terrorism, with Islam, and so on. It would never have happened if, you know, the pill had not been invented. So there was never anything like it in history. And with the impact that it had, I mean, probably the biggest, most important invention of the 20th century. Really, I can't think of anything else that had quite the impact. Television certainly did. You know, you could look at other things, the jet engine, radar, and so on, the atomic bomb. But probably this had a greater social impact than anything. But the impact was on the Western world, because, I mean, in Africa, nobody's heard of this, for example. And I would think that's true in most parts of the world. But certainly in the Western world, of course, it is widely used. And, you know, it just struck me watching this program. Well, yesterday afternoon we were at home, and the grandchildren were gone for a while, and we turned on the TV, and somebody had left it on PBS the previous day, and immediately the first thing we saw was some 60s rock stars, black and white. It was a fundraising show that they had on, and excerpts from the Ed Sullivan Show. Now, I didn't live in the United States back then, so this was all new to me. But I did recognize some of those groups. And I'm sure Mike and Bob would have done too, because, you know, Mike was at the premiere of It's a Wonderful Life. You heard him say that. So, you know, he'd remember as well these artists from the 60s. And it was all black and white. You had Mick Jagger, you know, jumping around. Of course, he still is 40 years later, but it must be quite painful now. And, you know, when Jerry and the Pacemakers came on, somebody made the comment that they probably all got their very own pacemakers now. But it was really amusing. And some of the groups we've forgotten all about, like the Animals, who looked really tame in the 1960s on the Ed Sullivan Show. But at the time, I'm sure a lot of parents were, you know, tearing their hair out, thinking that their kids were watching these people. But it's all rather tame now. But, you know, the 60s music, revival, whatever you want to call it, was a major social phenomenon, along with other changes at the same time. In between some of these excerpts from the Ed Sullivan Show, they mentioned that the favorite TV show in the year that the Beatles arrived here, which was 1964, was Father Knows Best. And a lot of people claim that the arrival of the Beatles is what changed America more than anything. I mean, there is this sense that everything changed in the 1960s, and that's true. Because all you've got to do, really, is look back, read anything from the 50s, the 40s, 30s, you know, look at any TV shows, any movies, you see just how much things have changed. And it all really came with the 1960s. And the Beatles have often been blamed for that. But in actual fact, it goes back a bit earlier than that. A friend of mine sent me a book a while ago by a man called Fred Kaplan. I haven't read the book yet. I've skimmed it, and I did look at it briefly for the purposes of giving this particular sermon. But the book was titled 1959. And, of course, 2 days ago, it was actually 2009. Now it's not. But it's 50 years since 1959. And the book shows just the changes that came in the last year of the 1950s. And they devote one chapter to a fundamental change, a major change that took place in December of 1959. So exactly 50 years and a couple of days ago, December 1959, and that was the invention of the birth control pill. This was to have broad social implications. Earlier in the year, the obscenity laws had been changed. I still remember this. I was at school in England at the time, and it was very much talked about that a case had been brought by the British courts and also over here in the United States, according to this book, against the publishers of D.H. Lawrence's Lady Chatterley's Lover. And D.H. Lawrence actually lived in my hometown area, just the next town, like 5 miles away, that's all. And he lived there during World War I, and so it was kind of a local sensation. And the book he had written was banned for decades. And then the publishers published it without permission in 1959. And they were taken to court for this because the book contained words and other things which were considered highly inappropriate. And they lost their case, as a result of which the obscenity laws were being ignored when it came to prose, not when it came to pictures, but when it came to the written word. The law was obviously being flouted from that particular time. Anyway, at the end of that year, the pill was approved by the federal government for use by the public, but it was promoted as a pill for menstrual disorders. The people who manufactured it, I've forgotten the name of the company, but the manufacturers knew that it would never be approved as a birth control pill. So they applied for it to be approved for women with menstrual disorders. It's interesting to read the background. I just read the one chapter, chapter 24 of this book. But Margaret Sanger, you know, who's now a hero of the feminist movement, Margaret Sanger had been a big influence all through the first decades of the 20th century. She was actually the publisher and editor of Socialist News. She was a socialist. She was very supportive of the communist revolution in Russia, the Bolshevik Revolution. And she basically hated men because, you know, her own mother had died very young, and her own mother had had many children. And the account in the book is that when her father died, when her mother died, at the funeral, she turned to her father and said, "You are responsible for this. It's your fault that mama's died so young," because, you know, she had had so many children. So she blamed it all on her father. And it became then a lifetime's goal to, you know, change the rules, basically, and to change the way that things were done. And she didn't hate men so much that she didn't marry one that was very wealthy. She married a guy who was very wealthy. There's always exceptions, you know. She married a guy who was very wealthy, and he actually gave her $50,000 to do whatever she wanted with it to achieve her political goals. And so what she did is she put it into research to find a pill that would stop women from having children, because she knew that nothing else would work. So this is what she did. And she talked to one of the leading researchers, medical researchers, who did the research. It took years, but finally they did come up with this pill. And when it came out, it was approved for menstrual disorders, but the inventor secretly let out in medical journals that it would also stop women from getting pregnant. Suddenly, hundreds of thousands of women claimed to have menstrual disorders and were prescribed the pill. The birth rate dropped so dramatically that by 1965, Congress decided to change the immigration laws to let in people from third world countries, including vast numbers of people from the Middle East, from Africa, and so on. And, of course, that has led to the problems that we've got now, you know, with terrorism, with Islam, and so on. It would never have happened if, you know, the pill had not been invented. So there was never anything like it in history. And with the impact that it had, I mean, probably the biggest, most important invention of the 20th century. Really, I can't think of anything else that had quite the impact. Television certainly did. You know, you could look at other things, the jet engine, radar, and so on, the atomic bomb. But probably this had a greater social impact than anything. But the impact was on the Western world because, I mean, in Africa, nobody's heard of this, for example. And I would think that's true in most parts of the world. But certainly in the Western world, of course, it is widely used. And, you know, it just struck me watching this program yesterday just how much things had changed in the 1960s and trying to understand it all. And it ties in very much with some conversations I've had recently and some visits that I've had. And not just visits, but counselings on the phone. I've had, you know, one couple talk to me about, you know, their marital problems. The guy is a young man, wants to leave his wife and children and just do his own thing, basically. And, you know, in talking to him about his life, it is clear that he got messed up before he got married because of the promiscuity of our age, which has been made possible by the birth control pill. And now that he's married with children, he cannot settle down. So he just wants to get away from the confinement of marriage and go back to being like an 18-year-old again without any responsibility, without any sense of commitment. And I've heard this so often, and it all comes back to the invention of the birth control pill. Now, within marriage, I'm not talking about the use of it within marriage. I'm talking about the fact that it's led to so much promiscuity. And promiscuity like was never known before that. You can go back in American history right to the beginning. And the Puritans, for example, in the 1600s, we now know by looking at their marriage and birth records, which are all preserved, we now know that 20% of Puritan births were within the first 6 months of marriage. So it is clear that the Puritans were not perfect. However, when the Puritans found that, you know, when a Puritan male found that the girl he was interested in had gotten pregnant, he did what was considered the honorable thing. He got married right away. And then, of course, they lived the rest of their lives as a married couple. They, you know, divorce was not something that was acceptable back then. And it didn't happen. It wasn't even legal in some of the colonies at that particular time. The title of my sermon today is 50 Years of Progressive Immorality. And inspired somewhat by these conversations, but also by watching these rock and roll artists from the 1960s on TV yesterday. You know, in the Old Testament, it's interesting that there is a difference between adultery and fornication. Adultery was punishable by death, but fornication was punishable. It carried a life sentence called marriage. That's how fornication was punished. If somebody got pregnant, then the guy had to marry the girl. But only with the father's consent. If the father did not consent, then he had to pay reparations because obviously she would be less marriageable if she already had a child. So the father's the one who made the decision, the bride's father. He's the one who made the decision. That was the Old Testament law regarding fornication. So a life sentence for fornication, death for adultery. There was a clear difference in the Old Testament. Either way, it put an end to sin. So that, remember, is what Jesus Christ said when the woman was caught in the act of adultery in John chapter 8. And she was brought before him. You know, her accusers wanted to have her stoned to death. But her, Jesus Christ then wrote in the sand, and he looked at everybody and he just said, look, let him who is without sin cast the first stone. Of course, everybody started walking away. But then he turned to the woman and said, go and sin no more. And so, you know, the punishments for these things were with that goal in mind, that there should no longer be any sin. So if a young couple had been fornicating and the girl got pregnant, then of course they had to marry. That put an end to sin. But if somebody committed adultery, then they had to be put to death. That put an end to sin too. Look at 1 Corinthians chapter 6. I'm giving this sermon today because we have a lot of young people here today. Our sermonette class was meeting this morning, and this is a subject that's come up there as well. So 1 Corinthians 6, verse 18. We're going to be looking at this whole passage, but I just want to begin in verse 18. If you have an old King James translation, in verse 18 it says, flee fornication. In the New King James it says, flee sexual immorality. And the New King James translation is more accurate. That with the word porneia tends to be translated as sexual immorality, applying to all kinds of things. But it's interesting to look up the definition of words. And the definition of the word fornication is interesting. It had a lowly beginning, suitable to what has long been the low moral status of the act to which it refers. The Latin word fornix, F-O-R-N-I-X, from which fornicatio, the ancestor of fornication, is derived, meant a vault, an arch. The term referred to a vaulted cellar or similar place where the physical acts would take place when people were hiring women for this purpose. And this is where we get the word from. It did not enter the English language until 1303. Doesn't mean it never took place before then, but in 1303 is when the word first came into English. But the Apostle Paul in 1 Corinthians 6 and verse 18 says, every sin that a man does is outside the body, but he who commits sexual immorality sins against his own body. So how does a person sin against his own body? Well, let's go back to the beginning of this particular passage. In verse 12, all things are lawful for me, but all things are not helpful. All things are lawful for me, but I will not be brought under the power of any. Foods for the stomach and the stomach for foods, but God will destroy both it and them. Now we get to the point about immorality. Now the body is not for sexual immorality, but for the Lord, and the Lord for the body. And God has raised up the Lord and will also raise us up by his power. Do you not know that your bodies are members of Christ? Shall I then take the members of Christ and make them members of a harlot? Certainly not. So he's showing that we have a Christian responsibility to take care of our own bodies. That means not to, you know, do anything of an immoral nature. Or do you not know that he who is joined to a harlot is one body with her? For the two, he says, shall become one flesh. But he who is joined to the Lord is one spirit with him. Again, you look at the scriptures and you see an analogy between this physical act, which is a betrayal of the marriage vows, and also idolatry, which is a betrayal of the covenant with God. So there is an analogy between the two. You're cheating on God as well. So then in verse 18, flee fornication. Every sin that a man does is outside the body, but he who commits some acts of immorality sins against his own body. Or do you not know that your body is the temple of the Holy Spirit who is in you, whom you have from God, and you are not your own? For you were bought at a price. Therefore glorify God in your body and in your spirit, which are God's. So we have a responsibility to God to take care of our physical bodies in every respect. You know, this is why we believe it's wrong to smoke, for example, because smoking, of course, does damage to the body. It's wrong to take drugs, so we believe that, we teach that, and it's also wrong to commit acts of immorality. But in verse 18, you know, what does it mean when it says every man, every sin that a man does is outside the body, but he who commits sexual immorality sins against his own body? Look at Galatians chapter 5 and verse 19. I was asked recently if we could have a team Bible study on this subject, and we will at some point in the next 3 months. But I think this is something that parents could start talking to their children about if they haven't already done so. Because we live in a society which is very immoral. You look back to the 1960s, this is when the change took place. Before the 1960s, you know, you could look at movies made in the 50s, the 40s, 30s. You don't see the immorality that you see today. In fact, they're not even comparable. It's totally, totally different. And it was the 60s that made that significant change. But the end result is that we've got a society with a lot of social problems as a result of turning away from God. In Galatians 5 and verse 19, it says, "The works of the flesh are evident, which are," and he mentions adultery, fornication, uncleanness, lewdness, and so on, and then goes down the list. It's interesting, in the book of Hosea, we see a prophesied consequence of the immorality. Remember again, the book 1959 shows this clearly, that it wasn't until the pill came out 50 years ago that you had the potential for all this immorality. It goes clearly through in the book, and I didn't want to read it here because we've got a family group here, but it shows clearly how before 1960, you know, people were just not able to get up to the things that they were able to get up to as a result of the invention of the pill. Doesn't mean people were perfect before that. Certainly things were done wrong. But when people did things wrong before that, there were always negative consequences. People paid a price for it. The price was normally that a guy had to get married. And so a lot of marriages started out with somebody that was already well along to giving birth to their first child. And then, of course, it changed with the pill. And this led as well to a rapid decline in the number of births. The book of Hosea, for example, prophesied this about the end time, and it's talking about the Israelite nations. And it says in the book of Hosea, and chapter 4, and let's begin in verse 7, "The more they increased, the more they sinned against me." The more they increased, meaning the more they increased in wealth. So as we became wealthier following World War II in the 1960s, the more the people turned against God because they considered that they had created the wealth themselves. They didn't realize it was a blessing from God. "I will change their glory into shame. They eat up the sin of my people." You know, look at the gossip magazines. You go through the checkout line. You know, they're just filled with gossip. And that's what people want. You know, I remember reading many years ago that when Time magazine first had somebody come and suggest that they start a People magazine, the editor of Time said, "No," he says, "people aren't interested in reading about other people." This was like 25, 30 years ago. You know, People was an offshoot of Time magazine. And somebody had done some research and found that Time magazine's one-page People column every week was read by more people than the other 99 pages in the magazine. So he suggested that they produce an offshoot magazine called People. And at first he was ridiculed. They just thought, no, nobody's going to read a magazine about people. Who's interested in reading about Hollywood stars and all these other people? But they decided to risk it, and People became one of the most successful magazines that there is around. And then, of course, out of that came all these other magazines as well. And today, I mean, you go through the supermarket checkout line, you can't find Time or Newsweek. Nobody wants anything serious. They just want all the gossip. And that's exactly what this prophecy said we would have. "They eat up the sin of my people. They set their heart on their iniquity." They want to hear all the latest sins that people have committed. "And it shall be like people, like priests." You know, even the churches condone the sin. Churches don't care. Most churches don't care. "So I will punish them for their ways and reward them for their deeds. For they shall eat but not have enough." We haven't got to that point yet. I think that might come in the future. They shall commit harlotry, but not increase. That's exactly what we've had in the past 50 years. More and more of this, but at the same time, the numbers of Israelites, and this is a prophecy regarding Israel, the number of Israelites keeps declining. And we replace them with all these other people we bring in, you know, some of whom have a desire to destroy us, want to blow us up, and, you know, whatever else they want to do. They shall commit harlotry, but not increase, because they have ceased obeying the Lord. You know, so it comes back to the fact, again, that we have rejected the laws of God. And, you know, I'll try and this particular quote here from the book 1955 mentioned before the pill, a majority of married couples used different forms of contraception, most of which were either not effective or because they were so personal in nature, they had to go to their doctors and, you know, they were not comfortable with it. But when the pill came out, it was easy and completely separate from anything else. In the 60s, the birth rate in America declined dramatically, and the pill almost certainly played a major role in this trend. The first advertisements for the pill showed Andromeda freed from her chains. You know, the ancient goddess Andromeda. Women had been vassals, but now they were free to decide to do whatever they wanted to do without consequences. The result was promiscuity on a massive scale. But it's actually left women in a bigger quandary, as men have little incentive to marry, and even less to stay married. They can get what they want without commitment. And this is the change we've seen. And the result is now more and more broken marriages, even amongst people in the church. And, you know, so often I've heard this, and in this last week, in talking to one couple, and nobody here in this room, okay? Otherwise, I would not give this sermon, because I don't want to embarrass anybody, all right? But I can tell you, this is often the way it goes nowadays, and for those who are older, for those who remember It's a Wonderful Life, and remember the animals and the beetles, etc., we may not realize just how bad it has become, but this is the way it has become in the first decade, or now the second decade of the 21st century. According to the CDC, the average person in the United States today has 30 partners before they get married. 30 different partners. Now, even there, if I can digress a moment, the dictionary definition of promiscuity has changed. I have an original Noah's Webster from 1828. Noah Webster defines promiscuity as just one relationship, one time, a one-night stand, basically, with somebody made you promiscuous in 1828. By 1982, in my Clark's Dictionary, it defines promiscuity as having multiple partners outside of marriage. The CDC today defines promiscuity as having six or more partners a year. You see how much our definitions have changed. And of course, with the changes in definitions comes a change in attitudes. So people today who limit themselves to five partners a year can say, well, I'm not promiscuous. You know, this is how, you know, this is how people's minds work. And of course, if you say, well, in 1828, this was Noah Webster's definition, they'll say, oh, that was just ridiculous. I mean, you know, nobody was like that, not even back then. In other words, people think the morality today has always been the same throughout history. But it has not been. It is a lot worse today. But this is the result. People are doing themselves a lot of harm. Because a lot of guys, when they get married, after having had 30 partners, and women are the same, there was no difference according to the CDC, a lot of guys, though, find they can't commit. They can't stay loyal to just one partner because they had so many partners. They regularly change partners, on average once every 3 months, according to the CDC. And so they can't stay faithful to one partner. And by this time, they've got children. They've got financial commitments. They've got obligations. But they can't stay faithful. And so they start looking for somebody else. And this has become a major problem. And so you've got, you know, more and more marriages breaking up as a result of this. And it is tragic. And, you know, my major concern always, whenever I talk to people, is I think of the children. And so often I hear the comment made. People say, children are resilient. And it's like children are just dismissed. They're an afterthought. The children will be fine. I don't believe that. I had one person ask me just a few days ago. He said, well, how does, you know, in what way is divorce a negative for children? And I said, well, first of all, divorce is the number one cause of poverty. Secondly, 90% of all the people in our jails come from broken homes where there has been a divorce. And thirdly, I came up with something else. I can't remember what it is now. But, you know, then there's probably a lot of other reasons. If you really dug deep into it, there's probably a lot of things you could think of. But I mentioned those first two right away. If you look at Malachi chapter 3, I don't have this in my notes. It's just come to mind here. But I think it's Malachi chapter 2 and verse 16. It says, the Lord God of Israel says that he hates divorce. And I've got to say, I've come to the same conclusion. I think of this whenever I get a phone call, I have a visit related to something like this, and I just think God hates divorce. And I can see why, because you can see it on the faces of children. And you know, it's interesting, historically, it's often been said that we go through cycles. Historically, there's a cycle of four different generations, and one generation is very conservative morally, like the Puritans were, and the next one relaxes a bit, and then the next one is much more liberal, and the final one is totally degenerate. But then what happens is it swings back completely, and I suspect that's what's going to happen, because the children of this generation, the children who have divorced, the children who have suffered through these broken families, are going to react and go the other way and become very strict. Just as I think when they experience having to pay back all the debts that our generation has accrued, they're going to become financially very conservative. In fact, you know, one publication I read to you, remember, said that our children will spit on our graves because of leaving them with this financial mess, and because we're leaving them with all this terrorism problem as well, because of our stupid immigration policies, and also because of the breakdown of the family. I mean, all of these things are going to contribute to them spitting on our graves. Look at Malachi chapter 4. Malachi chapter 4. So I hear this from guys saying, you know, children are resilient, trying to justify the fact that they're walking away from their marriages, and it really goes back to, you know, the way that they lived before they got married in the first place, and they just find they cannot change. So this is how we do harm to our own bodies. You can keep your finger in Malachi 4. I'll look back at 1 Corinthians again and just read that passage to you. The Apostle Paul saying that every sin that a man does is outside the body. So when you steal, it doesn't do any harm to your body. When you lie, it doesn't do any harm to your body. But he who commits acts of sexual immorality sins against his own body. Excuse me, I've got a throat problem here. But he who sins, who commits sexual immorality, sins against his own body. You do yourself harm, is what it's saying here. It comes back on you later on. Malachi chapter 4, verses 5 and 6 is interesting to me, because I'm about to say something very radical. Some of you may disagree, but Malachi 4 and verse 5, "Behold, I will send you Elijah the prophet before the coming of the great and dreadful day of the Lord, and he will turn the hearts of the fathers to the children and the hearts of the children to their fathers, lest I come and strike the earth with a curse." You know, we always used to think back in our former association that this was a prophecy regarding the role of the church, and I don't think that's the case at all. Because we did not turn the hearts of the fathers to the children and the hearts of the children to their fathers. In fact, looking back, you know, the divorce rate of conservative Christians, and you can check this up, one of those organizations, the Pew Research, or Barna, that researches religious trends, said this in a study that they did 2 or 3 years ago, the divorce rate amongst conservative Christians is higher than amongst people who have no religious beliefs. And I wouldn't think that exempts us either in the churches of God over the past few decades. So what is this talking about? Well, clearly, There's a need for the hearts of the fathers to be turned to the children. If fathers can so easily walk away from their children, if they can say, our children are resilient, they'll be fine, then obviously there's a major need here. I mean, I have sat with fathers. I mean, I get together with people, and I've seen young fathers. In fact, I take my grandchildren quite often to McDonald's, only because it has a play area. That's the only reason we go there. It has a free play area. So we go there, and, they love to play, especially when there's other kids there. But I can look at some of the others. Quite often there's young fathers there with young children. And, quite often they're just texting all the time. Or they're on their cell phones all the time. Or, because McDonald's is wired, they're on their laptops. And I think, we have a major problem today because people are addicted to all these electronic gadgets. And they have replaced relationships. So instead of relating to people, people are texting. Now, they're texting other people, presumably. So I guess there is some sort of a relationship going there. But it's easier to text people than to talk to people face to face. A number of states yesterday, laws came into effect yesterday that banned texting. I think it was 10 states that banned texting, including Illinois, by the way. So if you're going through Chicago, don't even think about it. Although you'd be crazy to text while you're driving through Chicago anyway. But, relationships suffer. And the two great commandments show that our lives should be based on two relationships, love toward God and love toward others. So relationships are more important than anything. But, a lot of people have a problem, and I think a lot of young guys, a lot of young women do too, I'm sure. It's not just young guys, but it's often the young guys that come and talk about their situations and their problems. And, I can see it also with the kids. So the children get very little attention, very little attention. And, just feel that's building up a lot of problems. When I'm with the grandchildren, I try to give them undivided attention. And I think that's extremely important. So what does this passage mean? Well, it's interesting to compare Malachi chapter 4, verses 5 and 6, with what it says in Luke. And then I'll read to you something from Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown and their explanation. They are a conservative commentary. It was written before texting was even heard of. Luke chapter 1, beginning in verse 5. Now this is about John the Baptist, who was also a type, an Elijah type. So the prophecy regarding, I will send you Elijah the prophet, a lot of people feel was fulfilled in John the Baptist. Also, Malachi talks about the end time, so it would seem as if we're going to have something similar in the end time. But in Luke chapter 1, beginning in verse 5, it says, there was in the days of Herod, the king of Judea, a certain priest named Zacharias of the division of Abijah. His wife was of the daughters of Aaron, and her name was Elizabeth. And they were both righteous before God, walking in all the commandments and ordinances of the Lord, blameless. But they had no child, because Elizabeth was barren, and they were both well advanced in years. So it was that while he was serving as priest before God, in the order of his division, according to the custom of the priesthood, his lot fell to burn incense when he went into the temple of the Lord. And the whole multitude of the people was praying outside at the hour of incense. Then an angel of the Lord appeared to him, standing on the right side of the altar of incense. And when Zacharias saw him, he was troubled, and fear fell upon him. But the angel said to him, "Do not be afraid, Zacharias, for your prayer is heard. And your wife Elizabeth will bear you a son, and you shall call his name John. And you will have joy and gladness, and many will rejoice at his birth. For he will be great in the sight of the Lord, and shall drink neither wine nor strong drink. He will also be filled with the Holy Spirit, even from his mother's womb. And he will turn many of the children of Israel to the Lord their God. He will also go before him in the spirit and power of Elijah, to turn the hearts of the fathers to the children, according from Malachi 4, and the disobedient to the wisdom of the just, to make ready a people prepared for the Lord." So that term, the disobedient to the wisdom of the just, Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown claims, you know, this goes back to Malachi chapter 4, turning the hearts of the fathers to the children. And what it's talking about is how a reconciliation will be effected in a generation, probably the next generation, which will turn them back to the God of their ancestors. Because we have lived through a very liberal period, a very ungodly period of time. I mean, if you polled the majority of people today in the United States, you'd find most people do not know any of the Ten Commandments. That was another survey, I think it was the Pew Research Center did, that most people could not name one of the Ten Commandments. And yet, 50 years ago in the 1950s, most people would have known most of the Ten Commandments because they were taught them in school. So this is a very secular, very irreligious age. And the prophecy then relates to the fact that a generation will come along. And the work that is being done by Elijah, not Elijah literally, but the modern Elijah, would turn the hearts of the children back to the religion of their fathers, the beliefs of their fathers. So a kind of a revival of faith, and hopefully the true faith that would take place. But the rejection of biblical values in the last 50 years is quite incredible and is the cause of most of our social problems now. And, you know, for those who are older, it's clearer to see that. It's easier to see that because we've seen the change ourselves between the 1950s and now. It wasn't that the 1950s was perfect, because it wasn't. There were still things that were wrong. But, you know, we saw this major social change that took place in the 1960s. And it was tied in very much with the rock bands and, you know, the Beatles, the Rolling Stones and others that, you know, were so popular at that particular time. Let's look at some other scriptures here. Turn to Matthew chapter 5. Matthew chapter 5. It's interesting, too, when you look into things, that all the immorality, for example, is very similar in its nature, in its root causes, to other addictions. They are addictions. In fact, one person I was talking to admitted to being addicted to three things. One was immorality. One was cell phones. And one was texting. In fact, even while we were talking, he was constantly texting. And you know how irritating that is? Now, I know somebody who is going to come up and say, you've done that with me, okay? And I know I do sometimes. I might get together with people, and I'm going to see somebody else afterwards, and I get a text from my wife, or I get a text from the next person, and I do respond. So I confess, I have a problem myself in that area. But I'm not texting all the time, okay? Some people are texting all the time. And, you know, I know that in this particular person's case, he admitted when I talked to him that he was texting another female who was not his wife. I do that too, but it's my daughter, Pallas. She texts me, okay? So I'll confess that now as well. I don't text anybody else, any other female. So anyway, it is rather like an addiction. And like all addictions, a root cause is a void, an emptiness in a person's life. An emptiness that can only be fulfilled by following the two great commandments. Because people don't have that relationship with God, and they don't have fulfilling relationships with other people, particularly in marriage, then there's a void there. And they try to fill the void in other ways. And, you know, texting and, internet addiction of various kinds, especially pornography, and that internet addiction is very common today, but also illicit relationships. That's an addiction too, and it fills that void. In a sense it does, but it doesn't really fill the void, of course. The void is still there. Meaningful relationships will fill the void and nothing else. A New York Times columnist, Nicholas Kristof, wrote recently, today, he said, conservative Christian churches do superb work on poverty, AIDS, sex trafficking, climate change, prison abuses, malaria, even genocide in Darfur. But the greatest social need, is alienation from God. And he was writing about Americans. And this was an article in Christianity Today in January 2009, so 12 months ago. People are filling the void with all kinds of addictions, drugs, alcohol, sex, entertainment, rather than studying the Word of God, rather than having a personal relationship with God. And this, according to this article, is the number one problem Americans have. It's amazing that the New York Times would have an article like this. You'd expect it in a more conservative paper, but it's in the New York Times and reprinted in Christianity Today. But alienation from God is a major problem. When I was talking to this particular person this week, I just realized that was his problem, alienation from God. And trying to find fulfillment in other areas. And, you know, when he was a teenager and when he was in his 20s, he got a high from, you know, each new conquest. And still missed that. And so he couldn't settle down to marriage and was about to leave his wife and children and, you know, just go back to what he was before, basically, which a guy who hung out at the bars all the time picking up women, and that's what he wanted to do again. You know, the alienation from God, I'm reading now from the article in Christianity Today, is in fact the first social problem. After Adam and Eve ate of the tree in the midst of the garden, the Lord God, with whom they had had a warm fellowship, sought them out. But of course they hid in fear and shame. From this, the biblical story unfolds to reveal murder, lust, greed, loneliness, pride, oppression, and a host of other evils that plague mankind. The biblical picture is clear. The breakdown of society is rooted in the breakdown of our relationship with our Creator. And the biblical response is equally clear. The way out of social chaos begins with people being restored to God. This won't solve all social problems immediately, but transformed individuals go hand in hand with transforming social networks. And it's so absolutely true. You know, the changes that were made in the 60s, I mean, they were put across as positive. Women had been, as that book 1959 said, women had been treated rather as vessels. And so, you know, now, with this latest invention, they were free. But the result was all the promiscuity, which has now actually done women a disservice. Because now it's so much harder for any woman to get a man who is committed. You know, I first started thinking about this some years ago when somebody made a comment to me. I can't remember exactly what we were talking about. But, you know, I said, well, you know, he's married. And the comment was made, well, that doesn't stop women from going after a guy just because he's married. Well, you know, it pretty much did 40, 50 years ago. But now it doesn't. Because now, you know, it's so rare for a man to actually commit, to actually want to be married and stay married, that other women then want him, so they go after him, even though he's already married. Because so many men just are unable to commit to anything. My daughter, who's 28 and not married, you know, she talks about how most of the guys that she meets, they just are not capable of any responsibility or any commitment. Now, that wasn't the case to this extent. I mean, obviously, there's always been some people like that. But again, if you go back, it wasn't like that. With my grandparents' generation, it wasn't like that, for example. But you think of the difference. Before the pill was invented, you know. You know, guys, when they had those hormones raging, they had no choice but to get out there and work and make some money in order to get a woman. And the only way they could get one was to commit to marriage, because somebody had to bring up the children. And so consequently, they developed responsibility and became mature much quicker. There's a lot of guys now in their 30s who are not mature. Failure to Launch. Remember that movie? Matthew McConaughey? We all laughed. It's close to home. There's a lot of guys like that, 35. I hope there's nobody here like that. I don't want to make you feel bad if you are. But, you know, there's a lot of guys like that who just can't seem to get their act together, but they have no incentive to get their act together because they can get what they want without having to commit. Matthew chapter 5. Just a reminder here, in beginning in verse 13, you are the salt of the earth. But if the salt loses its flavor, how shall it be seasoned? It is then good for nothing but to be thrown out and trampled underfoot by man. You are the light of the world. A city that is set on a hill cannot be hidden. You know, most of the people I talk to have grown up in the church. They should know better. But they're caught up in the culture in which we live. I would say most people, 99% probably, are more influenced by the culture than by what the Bible says. And that is because we expose ourselves to the culture more than we expose ourselves to the scriptures. You know, we watch more TV, watch more movies than we spend time studying the Bible. So which is the greatest influence in our lives? The culture says one thing, the Bible says another. The Bible tells us to be faithful to our wives, to just have the one relationship in our lives. Whereas the culture says you can have as many as you want without consequences. That's the thing that always bugs me, is that without consequences. And of course the pill enabled people to have what they want without consequences. But there are consequences. The consequence is that people are incapable of committing to a meaningful relationship for life. You know, that's been the end result of it, of all the promiscuity that was made possible by the pill. And again, I'm not, you know, putting down the pill in terms of, you know, for married couples. I'm talking here about the promiscuity that was made possible, you know, by the invention of the birth control pill. And, you know, we should not be caught up in the popular culture. You are the light of the world. A city that is set on a hill cannot be hidden. You know, we need to stand out as being different from the rest of the world. I mentioned before, when I go to Ghana, sometimes if I go to Kumasi, I'll be in Kumasi on this visit, for example. Kumasi has a very big Virgins Club. That's what it's called. And they now have about 600 members. And these are people who have committed themselves to abstinence until they get married. And it's always a delight to go there to this particular group and speak to them and mix with them. And they're from all faiths. Not one of the people there is from our own church. Because it's just two separate things. I was asked to do the one separately from being the pastor, or the regional pastor of the church. So when I go there, it's people who are not members of our church. There are even some Muslim women there. And, you know, they've all pledged themselves to abstinence until they get married. Their numbers have been increasing, but they won't increase rapidly because, you know, they meet other people there and they get married, so then they can't stay in the Virgins Club, you see. So they're kind of doing themselves out of business, so to speak. So they offered me a T-shirt with "I'm proud to be a virgin" written on the front, and I declined. It wasn't big enough. You are the light of the world. A city that is set on a hill cannot be hidden. Nor do they light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a lampstand, and it gives light to all who are in the house. Let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father in heaven. So, you know, we need to live according to God's laws in this area. But one reason I've given this is because as parents, I think, you know, we can do better. Because I think we have exposed our children way too much to the popular culture without, you know, talking to them about how what Hollywood shows and what TV shows, you know, are, they don't show the negative consequences of things like they should. And what all this promiscuity has done to our society, and the way that people can't seem to commit to relationships like they used to. I mean, obviously some people do, but most people seem unable to do that. And, you know, we need to help our children to, you know, walk through the minefield of, you know, of this society, which is what it is, and help them to realize some of these things. And I think we ourselves, those of us who grew up in the 60s, I was a teenager in the 60s, so naturally I was affected by all the changes that were taking place. And, you know, I think that has led to perhaps a greater degree of tolerance than we should have. We should recognize that a lot that came out of that decade really was evil and still is, and has led to so many of the social problems that we've got. And we need to, you know, firmly teach that these things are wrong. And if you live according to the laws of God, then you're going to be happier. Your marriages will be happier. You'll be able to commit to a lifelong relationship that is far more likely to last as a result of doing things God's way, rather than doing things the way that the popular culture does things, which results in so many broken relationships, so many broken homes, and so many children that are miserably affected as a result of divorce.